period into Afghanistan and left it a far less stable country, but ultimately were defeated. Now, some see that as an economic victory, because essentially that money has been directed to the arms companies and energy companies to an extent, and therefore it was a massive robbery of the United States, and that was precisely the goal of the policy. But clearly United States power is seen to be waning, and for the other emerging economies, particularly the BRICS nations, Russia, India, China in particular, to hew out an independent foreign policy where they rely more on each other, more on their mutual trade, more on mutual friendship, can only be a good thing for them and for the people of the world.
With the departure of U.S. forces from Afghanistan after 20 years of conflict, tensions rose again in Washington-Islamabad relations, and their dealings were subjected to conflict and reciprocated distrust. Following the change in Pakistan's administration and their struggles with various political and economic challenges, the U.S. saw an opportunity to mend its strained relations with Pakistan and revive its so-called anti-terrorism design in the region. Maintaining a military presence in South Asia, monitoring and controlling the region's large market, especially in the energy sector, and preserving its preferred balance of power are some of the goals that the U.S. is pursuing with its dual policies in the region.
Let me be direct about the competition between the United States and China. As we manage shifting geopolitical trends, the United States will conduct itself as a reasonable leader. We do not seek conflict. We do not seek a Cold War. We do not ask any nation to choose between the United States or any other partner.
Meanwhile, China's increasing influence in Pakistan and other regional countries, and the long-time competition between India and Pakistan, who are both nuclear states, over Jammu Kashmir, spell serious trouble for America's strategic ambitions in South Asia.
Definitely, Pakistan is a peace-loving nation. We do not want to have a hate against any country or any nation. If the U.S. was treating Pakistan unilaterally, we don't know about that one. But Pakistan was trying to narrow down the gap between the East and the West. And we were having a good relation with Russia and all other South Asian countries, including the China. China is our strategic ally.
In recent years, the U.S. has not seen Pakistan as a reliable ally. But now, seeing it as a gateway to Afghanistan, Washington is hoping to exploit the influence of the Pakistani military on the Taliban by offering military aid. After omitting Pakistan from the list of unfavorable nations, the $450 million F-16 deal, the IMF loans, and the FATF restoration programs are all adding up to a positive outlook for Pakistan's future relations with the U.S. government. But still, China, India, Russia, and Iran play a key role in their relations.
As a regional power and a nuclear state, Pakistan has always been a focal point for U.S. policies in South and Central Asia. But their constant concerns about Pakistan's future in nuclear arms and the possibility of extremist groups gaining access to their weapons have kept their full support at bay.
Geopolitically, American interest in South Asia, specifically in the region of Afghanistan and Pakistan, since past 20 years is determined by the war on terror and its objectives in this region. We see that since 20 years, it has been engaging Pakistan in relation to their power military apparatus in Afghanistan to eradicate terrorism. This is why they have this, you know, mantra of Pakistan doing more in order to eradicate the terrorism. But unfortunately, United States has not been realizing that after 2001, when 9/11 incident took place, our interests were not aligned. This is very technical, because the same people who United States used with the help of us in Afghanistan to stop the army of the Soviets were pitted against us after 2001, and Pakistan was forced to fight their own brothers, which is not possible. And United States do not understand this. This is why Pakistan has been called that it is playing double game with the United States because while they are receiving aid through the surrender and appeasement model, they are not using it to fight the people in Afghanistan, which they call terrorists. But the truth is that the other states do not want to see an Islamic fundamentalist government taking form in any Muslim country. So to me, the interest of the United States in Afghanistan and Pakistan has always been in relation to military security. And this is why the bone of contention still remains in between them. And there is a transition that is taking place, which I don't see that things will get, you know, better for both of the countries, unfortunately.
Although since the Cold War, Pakistan has been a key ally for the U.S. in fighting communism and terrorism, after Trump took office, he cut off aid to the country and changed U.S. policies toward Pakistan fundamentally, citing their role in supporting terrorism and unsettling the peace process in Afghanistan.
Pakistan was also a victim of terrorism. We were facing at least several incidents of terrorism in Pakistan after the 9/11 2001 till 2014-15, and we were also worried about terrorism in Pakistan. That was why we were cooperating with the US to eliminate the terrorism from this region, especially from Afghanistan and the bordering area of Pakistan.
The 1990s showed the U.S. that abandoning Pakistan may have existential consequences for America. Now they know that by pressuring Pakistan, they are pushing them toward their competitors like China and Russia, which will deprive them of having a major foothold in the region. If the U.S. still wishes to remain a key player in the region, and especially in Afghanistan, and continue its anti-terror operations in the region, it cannot do so without the support of Pakistan.
The U.S. was more worried about Afghanistan. They were fighting against the Taliban in Afghanistan. But of course, the bordering area between Pakistan and Afghanistan is so complicated that it was very difficult to differentiate where the terrorists are living, where from where they are coming. And sometimes they were doing some attacks in Afghanistan and then taking refuge nearing the bordering area of Pakistan. So of course, the U.S. was also considering the bordering area of Pakistan as a fight against the terrorism.
America's long-term strategic goal of containing China has always been defined in its cooperation with India, while China-Pakistan relations are entering a new era with the introduction of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC. The Belt and Road Initiative is another key aspect of their increased bilateral economic and strategic cooperation, which has fortified China's influence in the region. On the other hand, U.S.-Pakistan cooperation in regards to the Afghanistan situation, the Taliban, and also the terrorist groups will be a crucial aspect of their relations. Now, a new row of military aid to Pakistan could very well impact the balance of military power in the region.
Following the Pentagon's announcement regarding the sale of F-16 fighters to Pakistan, India's neighbor and competitor, India has raised its concern about America's decision to aid Pakistan militarily. This is while Pentagon claims that this new deal doesn't include new capabilities, features, or ammunition, and will not change power dynamics in the region. Despite that, the Indian Air Force is looking to introduce 114 new fighter jets to keep its edge against its competitors like China and Pakistan, 96 of which will be produced domestically and 18 fighters will be imported.
Effective to have United States as their partner, but that relation was meant to have, you know, equality. It was not, you know, meant to have a certain relation in which Pakistan would be in dependency syndrome. Well, that dependency syndrome came when after Liaquat Ali Khan declared that the world would be a limpid leg if United States is not going to help states like Pakistan. Well, United States agreed to it because it had, you know, its Bretton Woods agenda in 1945 when it wanted to have newly emerging nation states more in their club, where, you know, they would have, you know, the superiority of their U.S. dollar.
The vastness of the Indian Ocean and America's limited military presence there have turned cooperation with regional partners like Pakistan a priority if they want to preserve their interests in South Asia. This is while the recent criticism by Pakistan's Prime Minister in his meeting with the U.S. Congress has revealed that the White House is still forming its policies with the same intentions as when Imran Khan was in power, something that the Pakistan Muslim League ruling party finds unacceptable.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Nasser Abbas Shirazi. He's a senior lawyer and strategist and also president of Center for Pakistan and Persian Gulf Studies from Islamabad, Pakistan. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Shirazi. Now, after 9/11 and the occupation of Afghanistan in the name of stopping terrorism, Pakistan had a significant role in helping America reach its objectives. Now, my question is, what's the U.S.'s stance towards Pakistan today and what are its objectives in this country?
Pakistan enjoys unique geographical location in the region. It provides a road linkage between South Asia, Central Asia, and South Asia, the most important geographical hub of the region. Pakistan is also important for American designs in the region. American ambitiousness and the design in the region are based on one, to contain growth of China, two, to create a check on Afghanistan and the policies of Afghanistan, third, to create disturbance along the border of Islamic Republic of Iran, and four, in the region, America want no Islamic country to enter into nuclear club, and Pakistan has already achieved nuclear capability. And also, America want his boots in the region through Pakistan. Pakistan can also, as a geography, as an important geography, provide America with an access to check Russia in the region, because all the Central Asian states are in the region, and Russia has a strong interdependence and interlinkages with those states. So geographically, the importance of Pakistan is vital for American interest in the region.
So, Mr. Shirazi, how will close cooperation between Pakistan and China and Russia as America's adversaries impact South Asian geopolitics?
America want India as the main partner in South Asia to check Chinese influence in the region. So India has a Quad alliance with America, that is a naval alliance. India has defense pacts with the United States of America. Both are meant to check, to make India capable to be a potential threat for Chinese influence and Chinese growth in the region. Secondly, you can say Pakistan is energy thirsty. And in the region, when we look at the region, the quality of the region is this, that on one side there is Russia. Russia is one of the best military capable country in the world. Second is China. China is the biggest economy in the world and the largest growing economy in the region and in the world, and also a nuclear country and permanent member of United Nations. And there is Iran, an energy rich country. So geographical Pakistan, Pakistan has 220 million population, mainly composed of youth. So this uniqueness of Pakistan can provide the base for this region to develop as a a regional bloc in which China is contributing economically, Russia is contributing militarily and on the defense side, and Iran is contributing as an energy provider, and Pakistan as a manpower and as a geographical linkage between these all countries. So Pakistan is very important, and if there is a cooperation between Iran and China and Russia, this region is so capable, is having so potentials that it can make the region as a global global player in the global politics and the global affairs.
Last but not least, Mr. Shirazi, with the $450 million Congress bill to support Pakistan with F-16 fighters, we're seeing the first security aid package by the U.S. after 4 years. Now, the question is, what's their true ambition for such assistance?
Fresh United States support in Pakistan, support to Pakistan, financial support or financial assistance, is the price of regime change operation in Pakistan. Although Pakistan is undergoing intensive and massive flooding, so a big country economically and even politically is the best country where America can create a good level of influence, and America is doing that. So Pakistan is facing a financial crunch, and in the time of that crunch, the financial assistance provided by United States Congress of $450 million, Pakistan considering it very important for its economy, but the ultimate target of that is to facilitate the new government after the regime change operation in Pakistan, and secondly, to bring Pakistan under the American domain of foreign policy. So Afghanistan is important for them. Afghanistan also provides the route to Central Asian states. So America right now supporting financially Pakistan is only to facilitate its foreign policy in the region through Pakistan. F-16, they provided us with F-16, but F-16 are restricted, conditioned. Conditions are there that Pakistan cannot use these F-16 jets against some specific countries. And there are conditions that Pakistan is bound to purchase the spare parts of those planes from United States of America. And again, defense dependence on America is there, because if America denies that assistance, that in past the incidents are there, precedents are there, so ultimately Pakistan will facing a dilemma as per its defense capabilities. So America is technically advancing in the region through Pakistan by providing financial assistance to achieve their goals in the region and in Pakistan.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Shirazi for being on the program. He's a senior lawyer and strategist, and also the president of Center for Pakistan and Persian Gulf Studies from Islamabad, Pakistan. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Max Mean Man, engineer at Silicon Valley, tweeted that there are many things a resource and power-rich country like USA can give. Pakistan's economy is on the verge of collapse, and with them just coming out of a doomsday flood, the options are unlimited. But should you choose to provide F-16 spares, that sends a message. Senior customer support engineer Ajit Yadav posted a part of the statement made by Indian Foreign Minister Jay Shankar on Twitter that no one is fooled by claims that Pakistan's F-16 fleet are meant for counter-terrorism operation. Mushtaq Ali Rahimun, Vice President of PYO Taluka Dali, said that why exactly does Pakistan need all money? Didn't it just spend $430 million on F-16 fighters after the floods?
And that was our episode about the shift in U.S. policies towards Pakistan and the challenges America will face in securing its interest in South Asia. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. Stay tuned.
امام صادق سلام الله علیه پسری داشتن به نام اسماعیل.
امام صادق علیه السلام had a son by the name of اسماعیل. Once اسماعیل came to امام صادق علیه السلام and asked him for a consultation. اسماعیل wanted to share his money with a professional businessman who was an expert in business and transaction matters but was a drunkard man. امام صادق علیه السلام warned his son about accompanying such a man and told his son, The drunkard is the most unwise, so do not accompany him.
حالا پسر امام بود دیگه معصوم که نبود که یواشکی رفت پولشو داد.
However, Ismail gave his share of income to the drunkard businessman and did not listen to his father. Ismail lost all of his money. When he was on the Hajj pilgrimage, he faced the house of Allah and said, O Allah, I lost all my money, please help me and give it back to me. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, who was behind him, heard his request and stated, What are you asking for? The person who is trapped because of his own actions is not either rewarded or admired by Allah. In other words, we are responsible for the results of our actions. If we are trapped by our own decisions, asking for Allah's help is a null deed. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fake news about Kim Jong-un gets wall-to-wall coverage, but citizens of a key U.S. ally opposing a joint military exercise goes largely unnoticed, says Tim Sharrock, author, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Media Ignored Major Anti-U.S. Military Protest in South Korea. Stay tuned for more. In America these days, almost any information about North Korea, be it rumor, fake news, or just plain silly, becomes fodder for the mainstream media. From TMZ to The Guardian, reporters know there is an insatiable appetite for anything that puts Kim and his country in a bad or crazy light. But when it comes to South Korea, which hosts 28,500 American ground troops, and the Pentagon's largest military base outside of North America, U.S. media coverage is, shall we say, highly selective. That was made resoundingly clear on August 14th, when Seoul was the scene for the largest public demonstration in decades against the U.S. military presence in South Korea. Amazingly, not a word about the protest appeared in the U.S. media. That day, thousands of people chanting, "This land is not a U.S. war base," demonstrated against Ulchi Freedom Shield, the first large-scale military exercises between U.S. and South Korean forces since 2017. The protests were organized by the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, KCTU, South Korea's second-largest labor federation. They were joined by a range of progressive allies, including People's Solidarity for Participatory Democracy, PSPD, an influential citizens group founded in 1994. At a time when military tensions on the Korean Peninsula are escalating and there is no clue for inter-Korean dialogue, we are concerned that an aggressive large-scale military exercise will exacerbate the situation, PSPD declared, adding, "We once again urge the U.S. and ROK governments to suspend the ROK-US joint military exercise and make efforts to create conditions for dialogue. At the demonstration, protesters took direct aim at the heart of U.S. policy in Korea with signs that read, "No war rehearsal, no U.S. and no Korea-U.S.-Japan military cooperation." Outside of the Korean press, the only outlets to cover this massive showing against militarism were Iran's Press TV and China's CGTN, which provided extensive video of the mobilization. The single print story on the march appeared in Xinhua, China's daily wire service. Neither the New York Times or the Washington Post, which often set the pace for U.S. press coverage of Asia, deemed the demonstration newsworthy. Hypocrisy, yes. As we put in a sardonic tweet, every rumor, fake news, intelligence leak, or eyebrow twitch about Kim Jong-un and North Korea gets star treatment in the U.S. media. Yet, when thousands of South Koreans march in Seoul against U.S. ROK war games, not one peep. The contrast seemed to hit a nerve. By the weekend, nearly 6,000 Twitter users had liked the post and over 2,000 had retweeted it. The contradictions were evident on Twitter itself, as it often does with countries we are not supposed to think it. Slapped a label on one of the posts about the demonstration urging users to stay informed because this tweet links to a media website. With that warning, Twitter was effectively delegitimizing the coverage of demonstration. To be fair, political rallies on the left and right are a common occurrence in South Korea. Obviously, editors and reporters must make choices about what to cover. But in a country where a majority of its citizens support the presence of U.S. forces and a U.S. general has operational control over their army in times of war, a rally of several thousand citizens openly calling for a U.S. troop withdrawal is certainly newsworthy. At the same time, the drills have been a hot topic for years. In 2018, with much of Washington opposed, they were downgraded to computerized simulations as a way to build trust. During the denuclearization talks between President Donald Trump and North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un, those talks collapsed in 2019 primarily over Trump's refusal to lift U.S. sanctions in return for a partial shutdown of the North's nuclear infrastructure. This year, with North Korea regularly testing its long-range missiles, the new presidents in Washington and Seoul, Joe Biden and Yoon Suk-yeol, decided to resume their real-life exercises. The air, land, and sea drills, which in the past have mobilized around 50,000 South Korean and 17,500 U.S. troops, began on August 22nd and wind up on September 1st. Sadly, the discrepancies in coverage reflect old patterns going back to the early days of the Cold War. Editorial staffs of major U.S. newspapers and cable news shows and now Twitter's upstart crew are steeped in Cold War mythologies about the Korean War and largely reflect the viewpoint of Washington's national security community. Currently, both parties see in the North a determined and dangerous long-term foe and in the South a reluctant ally torn between loyalty to the United States regime and its expansive economic ties with China, America's new nemesis. In this world, there is little room for coverage of South Korean trade unionists, leftists, and progressives who stand against the American consensus. That mindset was recently on display at the Post when it praised South Koreans for electing Yoon, an inexperienced conservative hawk who said during his campaign that he might consider a preemptive strike on North Korea to protect peace on the peninsula. South Korea makes a welcome turn toward the U.S. just when it is really needed. The headline, crowed. The Post editorial also took a nasty swipe at former President Moon Jae-in parroting right-wing talking points that he had consciously played down North Korea's human rights record and balked at adding new batteries to the American THAAD missile deployment that has drawn Beijing's ire. For America's papers of record, the failure to cover South Korea's progressive left also reflects a failure of nerve. The KCTU and People's Solidarity that organized this month's anti-war demonstration have deep roots in the democratic movement of the late 1980s, when years of struggle culminated in the massive demonstrations of 1987 that forced the pro-US generals who had ruled the South for 26 years to step aside. During that era, both the Times and the Post offered extensive and often outstanding coverage of dissidents and government repression. But in the recent years, they have been far more interested in covering North Korean defectors and warning the public repeatedly about a possible underground nuclear test than exploring the complex internal politics of South Korea. Ironically, these papers are better prepared now to cover Korea than any time in the past 40 years. Since 2020, they have built large bureaus in South Korea and relocated their Asian news hubs from Hong Kong to Seoul, giving them an opportunity for first-class coverage of perhaps the most dynamic country in Asia. Stephen Dunbar Johnson, the Times International President, recently told the Korea Joongang Daily, "Looking at a 5, 10, 20-year horizon, Seoul just feels like it's right in the middle of the action." But in this coverage, the opinions and views of all Koreans need to be heard. That is particularly true when dealing with an issue as critical as the U.S.-Korean alliance, which President Biden has called a linchpin of peace, stability, and prosperity, but many Koreans now view as a barrier to their country's future.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your queries regarding the upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Well, human beings were created in a way that they hated unfair things. They hate, as you said in previous session, they hate lying, they hate cheating, they hate being unfair, and they also hate being violent. I mean, a human being, it's violence and torture is not okay for every human being. It's not normal. But what you said in previous session was that there are certain games that make you, that desensitize you towards violence and torture. I would want to know more on that from you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, we'll be talking about the dangers of the screen, so video games and animations and TV in general.
Yeah.
And we talked about worldview, we talked about role models, and we talked about desensitization, and we talked about sexual content
example.
And adult content and being desensitized towards these very wrong things that are completely wrong according to Islam and according to human perfection.
Yeah.
In last show, we talked about violence as well and how violent games and violence generally on TV, it desensitizes us towards being violent. And you see this, studies have been done on this. You can search it online as well.
Yeah.
We gave the example of GTA 5, which had a torture scene, which is kind of very, very, very concerning. But generally, even games that we play, one-shooter person games, such as Battlegrounds, for example, and other games, you get used to
shooting,
killing. You get used to violence, basically. And Call of Duty is the same thing as well. But what's more even than that is that very often you'll notice that you are facing an enemy that is always either Arab or different from us. You'll never be shooting a white guy, for example.
All right.
Or shooting playing a game which has a battle towards, I don't know, Europe or America. You're always on the side of America and Europe, kind of going towards the Middle East or Russia or other countries and fighting there. Brainwashing us to being very used to being
Western.
Violent towards a particular group of people.
All right.
So this desensitization also has a very strong worldview impact as well.
Well, there are certain parents who actually don't know about all this and they just give their smartphones with internet to their children without being monitored. And you're saying that this is what is being fed, this is what is being taught. So this is really important how parents have to be aware about all that.
Yeah. So the awareness is very important. Again, as I said, the reason why we're doing this why we're having this discussion is to bring about this concern for parents that there is something out there that we need to be aware of and take care and be careful. These games obviously don't have such impact on the first time you play or the second time you play. It's continuous playing for 2-3 hours a day, just like most youth are doing, has an impact. And violent, being desensitized towards violence is something that is quite concerning.
Exactly. Well, the last danger that we discussed, the previous danger actually was desensitization in which a person gets used to something that's not normal, that was not, that he may have felt regret towards or guilt towards. But how can we control this desensitization? I'll ask you that after a short break, dear listeners. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio @irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Pritha Mekhtar, and we're talking about the dangers that screens, animations, and video games bring with them. Yes, Pritha Mekhtar, you said there was a thing that used to be abnormal or unnormal, and now it becomes normal, and this process is called desensitization. You explained that very beautifully in previous session as well as in this session. I would want to know what parents can do about it.
What can be done about it is something we can talk about for all of the things that we mentioned in terms of worldview, in terms of role model. Michelle, at the end, we will talk about what can be done. Right now, the reason why we're bringing this is mainly to bring a concern. I want to kind of
develop that curiosity.
Exactly. Develop a mindset that we need to be aware that there is a danger out there.
A sense of monitoring.
Until we don't understand that there's a danger, we're not going to do anything about it. So the first step is to really understand that there is a danger, to understand that there is a concern.
Yeah.
And once we understand there's a concern, then we can talk about
the way out, what could be done
about it. Yes.
Yeah.
So let's move on into the fourth danger and fourth thing that we want to be aware of when it comes to the screen, and that is time wasting. So yeah. one of the very important concepts that we have in Islam, which is completely in line with what our logic and our fitrah tells us, is that if we want to be successful, we have to be very efficient and we have to use our time very efficient. Any strong businessman or any strong person who has built success in this world will tell you that one of the secrets is to make sure that we make the most of our time. Amir al-Mu'mineen has this very beautiful saying where he says that your lifespan is only the number of your breaths. So the number of your breaths are counted.
Oh, yeah.
So make sure that you are careful how you use them, because obviously each breath that you take takes you towards death and
Surah which says, a step by step, you're actually moving closer to a meeting with your Lord, and that's actually death.
Exactly. So we find that we need to be very stingy when it comes to how we spend our time. We need to be careful in what we do throughout the day. Where do we spend our energy? Where do we spend our mental faculty? When we are very fresh, when we can do a lot, when we can achieve a lot in our lives, are we using it in the right way? And you find that if you look at stats today in the world, you find that there are millions, literally millions of people who are suffering from video game addiction.
All right.
If you ask youth around, they'll tell you that there are many people that they know amongst their friends who spend hours upon hours on games like Fortnite or Minecraft, and literally unconcerned about anything that happens around them. Just focus on this. And it is beyond their control to stop it.
Yeah.
It becomes such a state that they can't get themselves to stop playing. This is called a video addiction. And it's actually a very strong problem.
Yes. And this is a problem that we may be inducing ourselves and our children. Well, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam said, a child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Pritha Mekhtar. We are talking about the dangers of screen in general, be that animations, be that any form of fantasy, be that video games. Yes, Pritha Mekhtar, you were talking about these dangers.
Just imagine. So one danger, obviously, this addiction is extremely, extremely dangerous. And the more we allow children unsupervised to play games, video games, or unsupervised watch things on TV, then it can lead to an addiction. But even if it doesn't lead to an addiction, let's say addictions is something that is very extreme when we talk about video games and animations and serials. But just the fact that we spend 3 to 4 to 5 hours, which is very an average youth will be spending 2 to 3 to 4 hours on the screen, whether it's a mobile phone, social media, or whether it's watching something on TV or it's playing a game. That's 4 to 5 hours is more than 30 hours a week.
Yeah.
Just gone on something that if you ask them after the game, what have you achieved? Like, did you achieve anything? They'll tell you there was nothing. There was no achievement out there.
Yeah.
Most people play or watch for entertainment purposes. So let's say you come back from work and you're tired and you want to be kind of relaxed. That's why you play a game or you would watch something on TV.
As a leisure time.
As a leisure time, basically. But that purpose, first of all, that very purpose, is it really true? Does a person who comes from work, spends an hour on TV, does he really feel more refreshed after that mentally? Is there no other ways we can do that? That's the first question we need to ask, really.
Yeah.
And secondly, youth out there, are they really doing it for that? Or is it something else that they want to achieve through that? And what is it that they're achieving? And you realize that it's very often empty. It doesn't have anything.
It's a wastage of time.
It's a wastage. And you find that at the beginning, if you really wake up a youth, you'll find that it comes with a lot of regret as well. Right?
Yeah.
They'll have a lot of regret that I just wasted 3-4 hours and I didn't achieve anything in my life. Like, these 3 hours just went without a sense of achievement, without a sense of feeling that I have achieved something, a real sense, right? Not an imaginary sense. On the flip side, right? If you find those youth that are productive, right? They're working from a young age. They do different activities, different projects. They build things, they manage things, they're into different types of
online marketing, business.
Exactly. They're very active, basically. They see products from their efforts. You find that they have this strong sense of, firstly, self-esteem, of achievement, and they're growing. Not only is their mind growing, but their skills are growing. They can do so much with their time. They have creativity. They have skills that range from computer skills to hand skills to different types of skills. And this is amazing to see for youth. And so the moment you put a screen in front of the youth, you're killing this ability for growth.
Exactly. So a youth has to realize that how much time he wasted, and even if he spent time, what did he achieve? Otherwise, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also says about this time that, I swear upon this time, you are in khusran, you're in great loss. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, you were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.